Guys, welcome back to another episode of the IsCast. This is our April edition. I'm here with David, Sean, Ben, myself, and Lee has joined us once again.
I'm back.
Huzzah.
He's back, baby. So hope you're having a great spring. The snow has finally melted here in the Twin Cities.
Almost.
But who's to say it won't come back?
Yeah, yeah. It is only April.
Guys, I'm being optimistic. We're going to kick it off here with a brief update for our company. We just got access to the Blackmagic 4K cinema camera via our friends at Cinequipped through David Ishida.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it just came to town. So I like to think we were one of the first people to try it out in the Twin Cities.
You can say that, and you'd be 100% correct. We would have been the first people to take it out on a quote-unquote rental, other than the little bit that it was pussed with by me
work. Were you the first one to test it at work?
I was.
Wow.
I was the first one to turn it on.
So for anyone who doesn't know, this is the Blackmagic production camera that shoots in 4K RAW. The RAW hasn't been released yet. It's a software update, but that being said, it is, for the price, one of the best 4K cameras you can buy on the market. And
$3,000,
right? Yep, $3,000. And if you don't know what it looks like, if you know what the 2.5 camera looks like, picture that with 4K decaled onto the front.
That's the only difference. It's physically identical.
Yeah, you can't tell. Like, the weight's the same, everything's the same.
Yep, it's about the size of, well, this tea kettle.
Yes, I'm glad everyone in our audience can see this exact tea kettle.
With a giant touchscreen on it and
a
sensor.
It's not that small.
Basically.
No, it's a little bit bigger. A
tiny bit bigger.
Okay.
Yeah. Look it up online. I have access to Google.
No one else can see.
It just has a different sensor, right?
Yes, it has a Super 35 sensor, which is why I were as interested as I was in the 2.5 camera. It's why I wanted to wait as soon as I found out that this one was going to be a Super 35, because then you don't need to deal with as bad a crop factor as you do on the 2.5, which is a Micro Four Thirds sensor.
So what we did is we took it out with one of our friends, Becky Shaheen, who was a lovely model for us, and we just shot her in a few locations around town, by the river, next to the skyline, and in the Guthrie Theater, to get a nice, I don't know, variety of different shots. And that thing's powerful, let me tell you. And I talked to you about this a little bit ago. 4K plays back. Well, our monitors can't really show how good the quality is. And so what I did was I exported a 1080 version and then I zoomed up about, I don't know, 30%, cropped it, exported it again, and there's really no loss in resolution.
Yeah.
And that's just how powerful it was. And I was impressed with it.
Yeah, and it's interesting, though, with the idea of being able to do that, to being able to pan and scan and crop technically up to 75% of your image, and you won't lose any quality when going to 1080. But a thing that's been noticed with a lot of people who've done similar things in professional work is you need to be absolutely precise in your focus.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times when you zoom up that much, you can find your hair off, and you won't see it when you're at full resolution or if you export a 1080 version of the full 4K.
Which is why I appreciate the focus assist that was part of the camera.
Yep.
That was brilliant.
Yep.
Focus assist, basically when you are changing your focus plane throughout the subject, there is this red kind of, I don't know, shadowy...
These lines come up that show up along where the sharp edges are.
Exactly.
It helps a lot. And I still recommend, you know, if you are going to do anything with a proper cinema lens and stuff, you know, pull out a tape measure.
Which we've never done.
But maybe we will in the future. But, you know, doing that can be helpful.
What was the lens that we got to use too?
We were using three Schneider prime lenses, and Schneider is an old optics company. They've been around for a long time. They used to make a ton of different kinds of lenses, but they got out of that. And right before, you know, this last year or so, they primarily did filters, like 4x5 filters for matte boxes and screw-on filters for DSLRs, you know, neutral density filters, you know, crazy colors, that kind of stuff. And then they recently just sort of jumped back into the prime market. And so they made these new ones. These are the Xenon FF primes, which are very, very nice. I love them because they're lighter than the Canon or Zeiss prime lenses. But they have instead of being really wide at the outer diameter, they're longer, more like an ultra prime, if anyone here knows Arri ultra prime lenses.
And as usual, the speak that David has goes right over our heads, his lens speak. We also got to try out an awesome filter that produced a lot of lens flares. J.J. Abrams worthy, I would say.
Yes.
Basically anything that reflected light became a lens flare in the shot.
Yeah.
It was a little overkill.
Yeah, it was a little overkill.
Because what we were doing is we were shooting by a river and we were aimed towards the river. And so a lot of light reflected off of the waves, the water.
The snow. It was so many points of light.
Exactly. But it was fun to use.
I think. Yeah.
So also... just happened is NAB in Las Vegas, the National Association of Broadcasters Convention, which is where they show off all the new toys that are coming out this year regarding production gear and everything related to that.
I think we talked production, principal photography, pre-production.
You've got it.
The whole thing.
Last month we hinted at David going to see it, and now he has seen it, and he has a lot to report.
I do. I will try and be timely.
Although he was technically there for Cinequipped, he was also partly there for Intersection, I'd like to think.
It's true. It's very true. Yeah, no, there was tons and tons of cool stuff. And I have to say, like, initially, like, this is in the Las Vegas Convention Center, and it takes up the whole convention center.
How
and
big is it?
Large. The central hall, which is where the primary, a lot of the camera and camera support stuff is, it's hard to judge the distance because there's so many booths and things. Some of them are tall, some are short, everything. I'm going to say 12 football fields.
That's pretty big.
And that's one hall. And I primarily was in three halls.
How many miles a day did you walk?
I don't know yet. I've been wanting to like pull up
Google Maps. You didn't carry a pedometer.
No, I meant to do it, but I want to look and find out. I probably lost some weight walking around there. So it was really big. It really was sensory overload because there was just so much stuff going on there. And it was annoying. Like, you know, I was mainly in the South Hall, Central Hall, and a bit of the outside area where they had some other toys. And so I went through them, and I between the areas over the course of 3 days, I've probably went through those three areas and a couple of the other ones, you know, at least 12, 15 times each.
And you know, laps. As far as defining the atmosphere, I was talking with, again, Becky Shaheen, who went there as part of her company, In the Groove. They work downtown Minneapolis, and they deal with licensing music to different companies. And she went there and said that because it's mostly young, nerdy guys and older guys in their 50s who do production stuff, they don't have a lot of women, so they hire hot women to come in and make the guys feel a little more comfortable, which I thought was interesting. And I said, I think they do the same thing for E3, which would make a lot of sense because it's all gamers.
Yeah. They've done that for a long time. Definitely, you know, it's the whole idea of the booth babes, which is...
Booth babes.
Yeah, and that's, well, that's the quote-unquote term.
Rid of them. It was like becoming illegal.
Yeah, it is no small point of issue over, like, you know women that are just hired for their looks, and you know you could go up to them and they know nothing about the product they're selling, you know, stuff like that. And so you know there are exceptions to every rule. There are some well-known, you know, cosplayers and people that get hired out by these booths, and they are
cosplayers at NAB?
No, I'm referring to other conventions, like if you go to Comic-Con or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was, you know, it's weird. You know, I spent all this time, 3 days walking around this convention floor, and I get back home and then I just see all these articles of all this cool stuff that I missed. And I thought I was trying to do such a good job of trying to make sure I saw every single booth on the show floor.
Do they do a good job of kind of facilitating, all the, I guess, quote unquote, important things to see so they can kind of efficiently guide people through it? Or is it just like a cluster?
It's a flusterfuck.
Okay.
It really is.
Okay.
It is so much, and you saw from some of the photos I posted, there's a couple of panoramas I took that I'll maybe send out and post them on the Facebook page, that like it is just so much stuff. And you know, you can tell, you know, some booths, you know, the small booths are 10x10s, and you know, they're, you know, usually no name companies that, you know, are trying to make a name for themselves. And then there's, you know, the other booths that, like Canon, which is like I don't know, 300-foot-long booth or something with, you know, all these camera setups and shooting galleries with all their cameras and all their lenses at them. It is absolutely ridiculous.
Wow. So what were some of the major announcements they did this year?
So the major one, and the one that is making the most waves, is the new Blackmagic Ursa and the Blackmagic Studio Camera. And Blackmagic has been doing a very good job in recent years of sort of being the flash in the pan, huge deal. And I think what Blackmagic is doing is they are doing to the prosumer, low-end professional world what Red did to the professional world of cameras, you know, what, 10 years, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, whatever it is, where like they're... You know, Red came out with we're going to make a 4K camera that you can buy for less than $30,000. And now Blackmagic is going, we're going to make a 4K camera that you can buy for less than $3,000. So they came out with those two new cameras. The studio camera is basically a 10-inch screen with a sensor on the other side of it.
It looks like alien technology.
It does. You know, it looks like an iPad with a lens on the back end of it. And
which,
you know,
considering the pocket camera, which is like an iPhone with a sensor, I mean, no. I don't put it past them to do something like that.
It is one geared towards, you know, use in studio. And you know, it could be nice because one thing, a lot of times in studio cameras, because you know you're dealing with a large lens body and a huge, usually a box lens at the other end of it, which you've seen a lot of studios, and your monitor is above the camera, so you're having to crane your neck back and look up the whole time. And with this one, you get to look down, which could be really nice. But with the Ursa, you know, that was making waves and everything, you know, it also has the same exact huge gargantuan 10-inch flip out
touchscreen. It is big. It's like an iPad attached to the side of the camera.
It is.
Three LCDs, right?
Yes, three total. So the 10-inch one, and then on each side, camera right and camera left, there is the same 5-inch touchscreen that you see on the production camera and the 2.5K camera.
Do you think that's redundant?
It isn't for what they're trying to do with it.
Okay.
Because they're trying to do it so you can have three people operating it all at the same time.
Yeah.
And it's nice because...
Director, the film guy, the audio guy, and
yeah, it would be AC audio and director of photography.
Okay.
And you know, and it's interesting. There are plenty of issues with it, which is why I personally actually have almost zero interest in the camera. One issue is, you know, it's going to be what, $6,000 or something. You know, relatively inexpensive, and well, very inexpensive compared to a lot of cameras. But like the current 4K camera uses 2.5-inch SSDs. Which you can pick up a 240 gig card for about $200, $300, depending on the type. With this new camera, it's using the CFast 2.0 cards, which are a new version of the compact flash cards that are being used. It was first announced for use in the Aria Mira, which is their new camera, and I'll talk about that briefly in a moment. But the issue is, for a 32 gig card of CFast 2.0 is $1,100. For a 64 gig card, it is $1,400.
A little overpriced.
So it's very overpriced. And, you know, it's brand new technology. Like, the write speeds on it are amazing, which is why people probably like it, because it will be able to handle 4K.
Well, 4K this raw. Is, I would say this camera, they're trying to not target the prosumer, though. They have the.
They're pretty specific about the 4K newsletter out. They wanted specifically target the bigger people.
Well, that's the other problems with it as well. The main thing is the flip out viewfinder is only truly applicable if you're on sticks. If you want to go handheld with it, you have no viewfinder now. You know, you have a 10-inch screen like 4 inches from your face if you have it set up on your shoulder. So that becomes completely impractical. You know, everyone I was talking to, with all this Blackmagic stuff, like a lot of the professionals are like, what in the world is this camera? It doesn't make sense. And the other issue is the weight. The Arri Alexa, which is the current standard of filmmaking, is 14 pounds. Which on your shoulder isn't the worst thing in the world. It's a little heavy, but it's not the worst thing in the world. This camera is 16.5 pounds. And that's before lenses, before shoulder rigs, before batteries, before any follow focus system, anything like that. It's probably going to be over 25 pounds, all said and done, depending on your lensing. You know, if you have one of the nicer, longer lenses that can be 5 pounds by itself, you're already pushing 20, 22 pounds or so. So it's just ridiculously heavy, and I don't understand why it's that heavy. I can't figure out what they put in there.
A little bit of magic. A little bit of black magic.
Yeah, there we go.
So that was obviously one of the hard hitters this year. Yeah. What are some other things you've got?
And the one that is a big deal is the AJA Scion. So they made a camera. AJA, previously they make a lot of converter boxes that, and, you know, studio, you know, rack mount stuff. These are sort of the same thing that Blackmagic has been doing, but the AJA has been doing for a little bit longer. And so they have a new one called the Scion, which is $9,000 or so. Many of the same specs, but it's only 6 pounds without anything else, which is remarkably light. It records onto their own proprietary cards, which are annoying, and they go for about $700 a piece for the lowest end one, but that's also a 256 gig card. So it's a lot more bang for your buck.
I'm not familiar with this brand specific to cameras. Are they breaking into the industry with that?
Yep. This is their first camera. Nobody saw this coming. This is completely unexpected, but one, they have good products as it starts out with. And also, apparently, talking with some of the engineers, they've been working on this camera for like 4 years, which is a pretty long time. So they put a lot of thought and effort into it. And so that's the camera I think everyone should be looking at, and what I've been steering a lot of people towards.
Sure. And alongside that, Arri released two new cameras, the Amira, two Amiras, right? You said there were two versions.
Well, it depends on how you define versions.
Well, I'm defining two.
Well, no. Well, then technically, no, there's
okay,
one.
Okay, correct me.
Okay. So technically, it's one camera with three different license tiers. So when you buy an Amira, your Amira, if you pay $30,000 for it, is hardware-wise exactly the same as my Amira that I pay $50,000 for. But my Amira has just more stuff unlocked within it.
Right.
Yeah, so when you get different tiers, you get different things. So, you know, and people are still going to buy that, even though it is $50,000 and it doesn't even do 4K. The highest-end one only does 2K. But the Arri sensor is truly an unsurpassed sensor. In the cinema world, they have the best looking.
You know, and that plays to a really interesting duality that I've heard a lot more frequently, and that is resolution versus sensor size.
Mm-hmm.
I was helping with a short last weekend where I was talking with the DP about specifically that issue. And I was talking to him about the Blackmagic 4K, and he said, well, what am I going to do with that resolution? Kind of coming from the Airy argument.
Yeah.
And he said, it's all about sensor size, which I think is a valid point. I mean, how do you kind of justify one over the other? What do you think? If you had to choose between sensor size or resolution.
Well, a lot of that would also depend on what lenses I had.
Naturally, there are a bunch of factors. But if you had to choose one over the other.
What's the sensor on the Airy?
The Airy sensor is a Super 35.
So they're the same?
Same as the Blackmagic.
Same as the Blackmagic. The Scion is not a Super 35. It's an APS-C size sensor. So it's a hair smaller.
Yeah, okay.
Not a huge amount. It's comparable. Not the same, but comparable.
So I guess between like an Airy and a Blackmagic, Blackmagic is still going to have the same sensor size.
Yeah. And for me, for right now, for this market, my money would go more towards the resolution. So going for that 4K. The reason being, the Airy sensor is amazing. And everyone in the professional world agrees on that. They have probably the finest sensors ever created. The issue I see is, right now 4K is coming, and it's coming pretty fast. Faster than HD came along. You know, we're seeing tons of 4K TVs out now. We're seeing more and more 4K cameras, more stuff capable of doing it. The codecs to broadcast the content is coming. But, you know, so I could say maybe 2 years, it will be almost predominant out there, everywhere. So the problem is going to come where you pay, say, $9,000 now to get a 4K AJA Scion camera, and you're ready for 4K when it gets here. And, you know, then you don't need to sell anybody on it. It's like, okay, we're doing a project in 3 years. Okay, cool. What camera do you have? I have the AJA Scion Touch 4K. Awesome. Let's go to the shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's going to become, I spend $50,000 on an Airy Amira, which shoots in 2K, and it gets to 3 years down the line, and it's like, okay, we need to shoot in 4K. What do you got? Well, I have the Airy Amira. Well, that's not 4K. Well, but the sensor's really great. And then it becomes this whole argument of having to have to sell that 2K camera for the better sensor rather than resolution.
Yeah, that's
a
point.
I think it will be an easier sell on resolution because that's what people are going to want, even if the image quality will be better on the mirror because it's a better sensor.
So then it
becomes a harder sell for it.
That reminds me of buying my first HD camera back in 2006, and a lot of people were like, dude, why are you buying that? TVs don't play HD.
Yeah, exactly. It's the whole, and what I like to do when I try and buy products is to get stuff that's future resistant, the stuff that is slightly ahead of the curve.
Not future proof, obviously.
Yeah, because I don't believe that there is such thing, because you won't have anything that's future proof. Well, I suppose a stone tablet is pretty future proof. You're always going to be able to.
Stone tablet.
Yeah.
All right, David, in 3 minutes, sum up the rest of the stuff.
Okay. So, in the other stuff, you know, 4K was out there, was everywhere out there. All the, you know, stuff is all based on the idea of 4K. G Technology, which does like storage hard drives and stuff and RAID drives.
Which so they copied the new Mac Pro look with their hard drives. They had the same exact.
Very similar.
Yeah.
A lot of it was geared towards, you know, broadcasting 4K, storing 4K, compressing a 4K, all that kind of stuff was everywhere. So as I said, that's coming fast. And so the other thing that there was a lot of were the UAVs. You know, everyone and their sister had a UAV of one kind or another, both for GoPro-sized stuff and for larger DSLRs. Not seen a whole lot that can do more than a DSLR at this point, because then you start tipping over the 5-pound payload mark, and that is starting to get into very large stuff.
So I can't use it to fly around yet?
Nope, not yet.
But also the Movi knockoffs.
Yep, Movi knockoffs was the other big thing. And all of them are going for much cheaper, going around the $5,000 price points or so. That was really cool. And the other big thing was LED lighting was also everywhere. And, you know, different kinds, and people are trying to get more, you know, get more variety than just the light panel stuff.
Now, you mentioned that it is cheap Chinese crap, I think is what you said. Now, what makes you say that? Did you try it firsthand?
Yeah, like so much. Well, one thing is, one that's funny is it's so much of it is looks exactly the same. Like I went to one booth, a company called ICANN, and they had these light panel like things with this little simple touch screen on the back that you can change the dimmability and color temperature. I went over towards one of the small 10x10 booths, and I saw the exact same thing over there, because, you know, it's all, you know, it's not like there's a million companies in China that are making these stuff. There's like 8. And so people just buy, you know, their second run stuff or stuff that's not quite as good, that doesn't necessarily make the quality assurance checks as the stuff that they're shipping out to their name brand company.
Sure.
The big one. So, and you know, it's difficult for doing stuff like, looking at stuff like that, because while some of it may not be complete crap, there may be some stuff out there, like, you know, our light panels, we haven't had any big problem with our light panels that we got.
Not yet, but.
Not yet. And, you know, but.
For the price, I mean.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we look at that and, you know, they're working fine now, but, you know, the issue is, when you're buying anything from Asia and from an Asian company, that is only based in Asia is the support problem.
Sure.
That if something happened with our lights and we're like, hey, we need a new light, we need you to fix this, then it becomes the issue of, one, do they do it at all? And two, we'd have to ship it to China then to have it replaced. Whereas if we bought from a company that is at least based in the in America, for example, like there was, you know, most of the stabilizers that I saw were all Chinese made or made from, you know, in Asia. But I did find one that was only $2,000, but it was made in, made in L.A. And so that one is much more interesting.
With the exception of Blackmagic, they will not repair your stuff if it breaks.
Yeah, Blackmagic.
I want to move on, but before we do, you went to a party at NAB, right?
Yeah, I went to the HAA party, which was ridiculous.
So many hot chicks that were hired to be there.
Yeah, I gotta say, it's really funny because like this was like it's one of the clubs at the MGM Grand. Like this was not going to be a cheap thing, and they bought out the whole club. So like 3,500 people crammed into this 2-story club. I did not expect it from AJA.
It was Hangover Part 4 for David.
Yeah, like, well, it's like that one. Like, I would expect that from Panasonic or Sony or Canon, like some of the really big companies. Not to say that AJA is small, but it's
Well, they wanted to make a big presence. They're new to the game.
Well, and apparently their party has been huge for, like, ever since they started coming to NAB. It's been a crazy thing.
Did you get to network at all? I know you met Quarter Digital again.
Yep, I ran to Quarter Digital, so that was really exciting. You know, and Sam recognized me even. He said to me, he like I was sitting there in the middle of the aisle, and he goes, oh, hey, David, how's it going?
Whoa, that's cool.
Nice name, bro.
Well, one thing is I was wearing my name tag, so he may have seen that, but the fact that he knew, and he looked at me, he's like, oh, hey, David, and for you guys who don't know, this is David. He helped us out on our DayZ short. That's so awesome. It was cool that they recognized us.
Well, if they come back, you need to let us know.
Yeah, no, I will. It'll be very exciting.
Awesome. So it sounds like you had a great time. Yeah. We're going to move into gadgets. Sean just got a new piece of gear that he is raving about. We just tried it out. Take it away.
Yeah, I did. I talked about the Subpack, I believe, in February. I'm sorry it took me a while to come back and have information on it, but it came in after a long, long wait, and it is awesome. I did a box unopening, an open box tutorial on YouTube. Of that, you can kind of see what it first looks like as soon as you open the box.
Just a quick refresh, what exactly is it?
So what the Subpack is, it's a tactile audio interface, and you wear it like a backpack or you set it on the back of a chair. There's two different models. The Subpack S1 you set on the chair, the Subpack M1 is the one that I have that you wear on your back. And what it does is has, I'll give some features. It's got two 1/8-inch jacks, one input, one output, and it has one intensity knob and one power button. And what it does is you have your source audio. It could be anything like a cell phone all the way up to your headphone jack on your audio interface. And you input that to the Subpack, output your headphones to your ears, and then
let it rip.
You let it rip. Yeah, that low energy is directed right to your body, and man, it is awesome.
And it simulates the feeling of being in a club.
Exactly. That was the goal. Their goal was to that visceral experience that you have when you're on the club floor of your favorite DJ.
So it's a subwoofer on your back.
No, it's not a subwoofer on your back.
How dare you blaspheme?
I'm trying to dumb it down for
That's not insult our audience. We're trying to simplify.
No. Put it in a soundbite.
It's supposed to mimic the feel of a subwoofer hitting your body on a club. It's not a subwoofer. It's not meant for sound. It's meant for tactile, for touch.
Mm-hmm. What did you guys think when you tried it out?
That was awesome.
I really want to try it with a video game.
Yeah.
I want to do a Halo or something fantastic. With that.
I would love to see these like more implemented in life. Like put that in my car or like put in the backseat of my car or something like that. Or
definitely would keep you awake if you do a long drive.
We talked about that last month, though. The whole point of having bass in your car is for other people to hear it, not just you.
This is definitely a singular experience. Right. But my wife and I each got one, and we daisy chain them together and watch movies with it now. The first night that we got it,
More connected?
Oh, we watched Cloverfield. And I swear, that point when they're in the street fighting whatever the hell
military
that
comes
is,
through,
Yeah, it was amazing.
I believe that's the part where the guy's like,
oh my God.
Yeah, I tried it out with my iPhone, just a random club song, and it worked pretty well. Not as well as the lossless audio that you were dealing with. What was that, Ableton?
I use Tractor Scratch Pro to mix music with, I use WAV files in Ableton Live, and I use AIFF or WAV files in Tractor. And the high quality files, you definitely have more. That's going to hit the. It's going to be a better experience. The lower
it's going to be translated better by the Subpack.
Exactly. Yep.
For everyone who doesn't know, Sean is a semi-professional DJ / video DJ, and he has a host of gear that he spent a decade playing around with. And your newest thing is 3D projection. I think we talked about that last month.
Yep.
But you love to use this thing to mix with at your station, right?
Yep, I do. I wear it. I wear it on my back when I mix music, and it's the best way to monitor that low end that you're giving to the audience. You know, there's no way that you can replicate that because you're behind the substacks.
Sure.
You know, but when you have that on your chest, it's instantaneous. You don't have that millisecond delay. So
how does it work when you're trying to cue up a different song? Which, are you hearing both at the same time with your subpack?
That's the beauty about the interface I use. I use a Kai EIE Pro, and I can switch between my monitor source and the combination of the two. So once I go to my headphones and now my subpack, that's all I hear. Is that.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I love that the knob is intensity. It's not like volume or anything. It's just like,
yep.
How intense do you want this experience to be?
Very, very accurate.
Yeah, we made the joke that once Lee gets his hand on the Oculus, he's going to have an Oculus, one of these, and sitting at his desk in his own Matrix universe.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Are you? Do you want to get something like this eventually, or is it not?
Actually, yeah. What is that, like 250?
The Subpack M1 is 350, and the S1 is 300.
Awesome. Are there supplemental pieces coming out to add to this experience or anything like that?
So far, it's just the M1 and the S1. As far as other accessories, they haven't really said anything except for 1/8-inch cords, and I imagine battery packs at some point.
That's
so
awesome.
Mm. Oh, and one more note on the battery pack itself. I haven't charged this thing once since the first day I charged it, and it came about a week ago, and I use it nonstop.
That's today, crazy. What is it rated to last for?
I don't even know. I didn't read the instructions that far.
It just lasts forever.
Yeah, it lasts, 2 weeks.
It uses your just good vibes as energy.
Wonderful.
I would like to see a smaller interface box on that, though.
Yep, I understand completely where you're coming from.
Like 5 inches by, or four?
I'd say three by 2.5. Yeah. Yep.
So. That's not
decently
bad.
Sized.
Yep. For being mobile, you know, like walking around the street or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Cool. There was another piece of awesome equipment announced or released or both. Oh, it was a Kickstarter.
Yeah, it was a Kickstarter. This, let me pull it up right here. It is, I'm looking for a title. M3D LLC over in Bethesda, Maryland.
Basically a mini 3D printer for the consumer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's they originally started the price. The introductory price on Kickstarter was $200. And now it's at $300. But it's a... let me see if I can get dimensions for you.
It seems definitely smaller than the MakerBot or the Proxima printer.
Mm-hmm. Ours it's much smaller. I would say it's probably even a fourth of our size.
But you can still print Legos or little knickknacks here.
And that's
there.
What it's kind of figurines. For. I'm buying specifically just so I can have like custom little parts for any sort of project that I do. Just that I can 3D model myself and just toss in there.
Yeah. But, I think it was only a matter of time before something like this came out.
Yeah, and you know, it's cheap, but it doesn't necessarily look cheap. It looks like a finished product. And so I went ahead and backed it on Kickstarter. I think I'm supposed to get it like in September this month or this year. So
when does the Kickstarter end?
It ends in 23 days from today.
Okay. So if... May 5th. So if you want to get one by May 5th, did they say what the price is going to be after the Kickstarter's done?
They haven't said that.
I'm assuming they're just going to try and still sell it afterwards.
Yeah. I would think so.
That's just the logical choice.
Based on other stuff that I've seen go for sale on Kickstarter, I'm guessing it's going to be about $200 or so more than whatever his price. Like so if it's $300 they're selling it for right now,
mm-hmm.
it's probably going to be between $450 and $500.
That would be my guess.
Do they talk about the cost of the material you're using to print?
They do not talk about that, unfortunately. Oh, it's May 7th, by the way. May 5th.
It's May 7th. I hope they, I hope they include... Maybe a little bit of the plastic to use.
I don't think for the reward that I chose,
that's
they
extra.
Won't. But they
that's
have
that's a separate Kickstarter.
Yeah, yeah. There's a reward above mine that's like for $600 that includes three filament spools.
Okay, so you're gonna have to buy that by yourself. Oh, Lee, where do you get that from? Where did we get ours from?
Amazon, I believe it was.
The filament.
Yeah.
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 Amazon. It's pretty cheap. What it's $24 for.
$30,
yeah, for 50 meters or something outrageous.
50 meters.
Yeah, we haven't even gone through one yet, have we?
Mm.
Yeah,
it takes a long time.
You got a lot of Legos.
I have tech specs if I can go through that real quick.
Yeah,
go right ahead. So it's a cube, 7.3 inches per side. It's pretty light, 2.2 pounds. It's compatible with Windows, Mac, Linux, and all that jazz. Supports many different types of materials, ABS, PLA, nylon, and more, it says.
And more. I like the and more.
Ooh, sausage.
The filament standard is 1.7 millimeter. So, and I think that's pretty
1.7
much
1.7 mm. How thick is ours? Is it 1.5? I think, Lee?
What was it?
The filament size on ours is 1.5? 1.3, I think. With a deviation of 0.2 plus or minus, I think. What is our spec out to be?
I don't remember.
Something like that.
Millimeter?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that. Interesting. Sounds okay.
Right.
1.5. Yeah.
And I think the last little bit is just it has a 50 to 350 micron layer resolution. I don't know. Lee, do you have any idea how good of a resolution that is? I have no idea.
Micron sounds pretty legit.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
ours is in micron.
I'm not familiar with that measurement.
Okay.
Everybody uses different, metrics.
Okay. Whichever one sounds
so like,
the best.
So, like, someone's like, this is this many microns. They're like, this is this many teratrons.
Yeah.
I have Qtrons over here. Awesome.
Exactly.
Okay, so we're going to move into world media at large, and then later on the movie of the month, which was the Grand Budapest Hotel. First of all, Ben, you recently went to New York and had an awesome experience with a couple iconic men in the film and stage industry.
Yeah, I got to meet Sir Ian McKellen and Sir Patrick Stewart right after, or at the stage show, or after one of their shows that they were performing No Man's Land and Waiting for Godot out of the Court Theater. I only got to see No Man's Land and did not get to see Waiting for Godot. The last two tickets were sold right in front of me. It was devastating. But if I had seen Waiting for Godot, I probably would not have met them. So that was the trade off. When Patrick Stewart came out, I asked him like, hey Patrick, how's it going?
And you called him Patrick?
No, I said Patrick Stewart. I'm sorry. I'm just saying that right now.
You said wait, Patrick Stewart. He's a knight, you bastard.
Sir Patrick Stewart.
Anyway, I said hi.
Again, the blasphemy.
I said how you were doing. And he turned to me and he looked away, started signing someone else's, and he came back to me and just like rolled his eyes at me. And I just kind of geeked out because like you know how I'm feeling. Kinda, yeah, I don't know. It was weird. Anyway, and then Ian McKellen came out and he said hi to everybody. And he came over. I asked him to come back to the Guthrie. Because both have acted there, so I was, hey, come back to Guthrie, it'd be great. And they were like, both, yes, I would love to come back to the Guthrie.
No way.
Yeah.
Well, I worked there, so I could take you guys behind the scenes.
Yeah, totally.
And we could accidentally run into them after the show.
Does,
hey, guys.
Does Ian McKellen, like, then cross the street and yell at taxis, you shall not pass?
Without picking me up.
Happened, no. That would have been great.
Well, that's awesome, man.
Yeah, no, totally.
Cool, so... real quick before we go into our movie, there's a little tidbit about the Hunger Games.
Yeah, the Blu-ray that was pushed out to everybody. It changes aspect ratio from when they from when Jennifer Lawrence's character leaves the Capitol, or at least the pod that brings her up into the arena. That whole transition from that world to the arena, it changes aspect ratio and does it actually quite well. You don't even really tell unless you're looking for it.
Do you know this? If this was in the theater or just Blu-ray?
I think the article just talked about the Blu-ray, but I wouldn't be surprised if it changed it in the
theater. Did they say why they did that?
No, but I would imagine just because you're leaving a different atmosphere.
Looking at the I don't know if you guys can hear me, but looking at the Reddit thread, one user talks about how they filmed the arena with IMAX cameras,
okay,
and not the whole film. So
interesting.
That point, you can actually, when you're viewing it on TV, you don't get the top and bottom full view because your TV can't go in an IMAX aspect ratio.
Yeah,
there's only like 100 theaters can do that.
Yeah, no, it's going to be interesting because as IMAX is transitioning into digital, I'm wondering if as it's cheaper and quieter, because that's one issue with IMAX cameras is they are obscenely huge. They're probably, 2 feet wide by about 3 feet long or something. They're absolutely gargantuan and they're incredibly, incredibly loud. So they're hard to. That's why they really haven't been used in that many films as a primary camera. But
it really makes you marvel at the guys who shot the Everest IMAX documentary.
It really does. And you know, for stuff like that, they sometimes like because IMAX has its own like special mechanics department, and they create prototype new cameras. And so they have like special ones that went to Everest. They have special ones that went into space. Special ones that go underwater, that kind of stuff. But as it transitions to digital, I'm wondering if more people will decide to use it, and maybe someone will do a whole film in IMAX if it's lighter and quieter. Based on what it is when it has to be on film.
Do you guys know if the same thing happened in A Dark Knight? Because he shot some of it in the IMAX in an IMAX cameras and others.
Yeah, they broke 35. One.
I think the only time you really saw that difference is when you watched it in IMAX.
Okay.
It natively, if you watched it in a standard theater, you didn't see the difference.
But there wasn't an aspect ratio change.
No, I think they expanded the 35 stuff.
That would make sense.
Yeah, and that's the one where they broke the IMAX camera too.
Yep.
How did that happen again?
They were filming the scene with the semi truck flipping over.
Yeah.
And they had the IMAX camera on an offset arm off of a pickup truck, so off to the side, and they were driving too close to another car, I think, when they were resetting, and it smushed it. And then completely trashed. You know, a camera that I think is worth a couple over $1 million.
Seriously?
Yeah. They're not cheap cameras.
I can just imagine, like, the silence is falling over the entire crew, and then someone yelling out, shit, yeah, really loud.
There was only five of those particular kinds of IMAX cameras out there, they trashed one of them.
How big is the film print on IMAX? It's like 70 millimeter.
70 millimeter, but also sideways.
Oh,
so it's 70 millimeters across, like the film.
So is that four times the size of 35?
Something obscene.
So it's like what 4K is for HD, essentially.
It's even more than that. Here's the other thing: if you take a 35 millimeter film and equate it to pixels, which is hard to do because it's not pixel; it's chemical. It is approximately 8K.
Oh, resolution. Yeah. I just mean like in relation, 35 millimeter in relation to IMAX is like HD related to 4K. That difference inside, like 4K is four times HD. So
I think it's bigger.
Okay.
Because it's sideways, with the film sideways.
So IMAX is bigger than four times.
Yeah, I think so.
35. Okay.
Then real quick with the pixel thing. So, you know, 35 millimeters is about 8K. So we're getting close to that. But IMAX equated in pixels is like 17K. It's obscenely high
resolution. Which is why you need those enormous screens.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Truly appreciate it.
Awesome. So, again, this is the movie that we decided to see this month, Grand Budapest Hotel. At least I wanted to see something a little more on the unusual side, maybe artistic side.
Yeah, artistic side.
Yeah. And this is, I think, my first film that I saw from this director.
Oh, Wes Anderson. Really? You're this first one? Oh, yeah. Interesting.
I haven't seen The Life Aquatic or any of those films.
Oh, interesting. I'd love to hear your opinion.
I saw The Fantastic Adventures of Mr. Fox. That's the only one I've
seen. No, The Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Thank you. The Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Sir Ian McKellen. Yes. Or Sir Patrick Stewart. They're both sirs. They're both sirs.
Yeah. Didn't I say both sirs? I said that.
When you talked to them, though, did you say sir?
Yes. But then they weren't responding to that, so I imagine they were like upset. So I stopped. I dropped the sir.
You ran after them, sir Ian McKellen. Anyway, sorry, we're moving on. Yeah. Okay, well, I'll start off. I thought it was enjoyable. You know, it was a really interesting movie. There wasn't like a clear, concise theme at the end that I could walk away with fully grasping. It was kind of something that I don't know. What do you guys feel that way?
Yes.
Okay, well, we'll come back to you, David, because you have bad things to say about the film.
Mm-hmm. Bad things? I'm just cynical now.
You know, right off the bat, you get the feeling of its animated comic nature because of the animation, like the cartoony animation mm-hmm. they have in the beginning. Also, what's with the Inception-style storytelling? It starts with this woman at a grave. It goes into an author and goes into this other story at the hotel and into a further story.
Which is the main story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed it too. I wasn't
like
sure about
four
that.
It's four in one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then even within that, there was one brief flashback.
Too many
yeah,
Inception.
It was really ridiculous.
Inside of a taco, inside of a Taco Bell, inside of your dream.
Well, then I wasn't sure. So we're doing spoilers, right? Yes, cool.
No.
We're spoiler free now on this podcast. You haven't seen it?
Okay, well, this doesn't go into it very much, but at the very opening, the woman who is reading the book, so the first dream, the first layer of the Inception, mm-hmm. she's walking up and she goes up to the statue of the author and then she puts something back. Like, is it a key or something like that?
I missed that.
They look like hotel keys.
Yeah. I wasn't at all sure of that.
Oh, so maybe she had gone to the hotel and took that key and
perhaps.
Left it for him?
I don't know.
Also, is this based off of a book?
It said it was inspired by the works of somebody at the very end.
Because I was unclear about the role of the author. This is two layers deep. I was confused at why he was in the movie, I guess. Because he seemed to just serve the role of setting up layer three.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not seeing anything. I'm just bunching it up real quick.
I think it's so you could see Zero, the character, and how the story had affected him.
Zero is the main character, by the way.
Yes.
Zero is the lobby boy.
Yes.
And the story is told by the older version of himself to Jude Law's character.
Mm-hmm. The author.
Who is the young author.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't. I forgot to pick up on that.
Yeah. So it's a weird thing that you're right. Like it seems that those top two layers didn't necessarily need to be there.
Okay. So how it's set up is this girl's at a grave of this author. The author then is setting up. He's like talking to a camera, right? Who's he talking to?
It seems like it's a camera.
So he's talking.
Because there's a light came on him.
Mm-hmm. So he's talking to a camera, talking about when he was younger, listening to this story being told to him, who in turn was telling the story of when he was younger. So
it's all just very absurd.
It's very absurd. I like mm-hmm. that.
Yeah. And it's very much in line with many other of Wes Anderson's films. But I don't know. Have you guys seen about other Wes Anderson's?
No.
Fantastic Mr. Fox is the only one I've seen.
So anyway, Ben, you were talking about the Zero's character.
Yeah. So I think I was trying to lend to maybe the reason why it's the way it is.
Sure.
So like the Jude Law's character, his perspective of the story is through Zero, and he's looking at the older version of him. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of see how the story has affected his Zero's growth and who he is, why he looks old, why he looks tired. And you have when he comes to visit the hotel, the Zero, the character at the in the second layer, Jude Law narrates, and he describes the man as everyone in the hotel is solitary on their own. But this man, Zero, is the only one who looks to be lonely.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of little things in there that they just briefly touch on that I think requires multiple viewings to really dissect and get the feel of.
Yeah, I'd agree.
But I liked it a lot, and I was paying attention right away to the technical side of the storytelling. I don't know if you noticed, David, they used a lot of lenses that bent the horizontal lines, kind of bowed it out a little bit. When we're three layers deep here, all the horizontal lines were kind of like bowed. Did you notice that?
I did notice.
A little more wider angle lens,
I think. Well, also I believe Wes Anderson is also a fan of using anamorphic lenses.
Sure.
As his primary shooting thing.
What is that?
Anamorphic is a kind of lens that basically it just, excuse me, when you're filming, it distorts the image to be narrower. So you're basically, you're able to record this is simplifying it a little too much, but you're able to record, say, a 16:9 image, but it is distorted so that it fits onto a 4:3 piece of film.
Oh, okay.
And then you need to have a special lens at the other end to undistort it back to normal, but that can still lead to a few distortions.
I noticed that because I guess I saw a lot of the images in 4:3, but were they actually
4:3? No, so what happened was when he got into the bottom layer, they did pillar boxing because, and I took this to mean this is an earlier time, so film is shot like this, basically, because this takes place in like the late 30s, I believe. And so they pillar boxed the film, which was kind of funny at first. I mean, it was quirky, I guess. Mm-hmm. I took it to add to the film's quirkiness, but I kind of like forgot about it after a while because you just kind of get caught up in the stories. I think one of the things that I loved the most about this film was the character Mr. Gustav. He, played by Ralph Fiennes, who also played Voldemort in the Harry Potter series. I thought his character was wonderfully charming and articulate, and I would watch it again just to see his performance because he always had an intrinsically phrased thing to say about whatever he was experiencing.
Yeah.
If there's one thing about this show or this movie, was that it was brilliantly written. Like, it was just very pleasant to listen to.
I thought it was very well
written. I could see you being that character, Wade.
Me?
I would
love to be that character.
We'll write it. And you can also see, since you guys haven't necessarily seen some of the other Wes Anderson's films, I've seen some of the other ones. And there are... Wes Anderson is one of those directors that when they sort of meet their epic group of actors, they continually work with them nonstop. Bill Murray's in a bunch, Jude Law's in a couple. Who are the other people?
There were a lot of great cameos in this
Owen
film.
Wilson, yep. Wilson. Yeah, there were tons of cameos for a lot of the other concierges from other hotels. Jeff Goldblum has been in a couple other ones. I want to say F. Murray Abraham has been in an
Edward Norton one. Was in it too.
Yep, Ed Norton's in it. William Defoe is in it.
Yes, he is. In a very, very intense role. Yeah.
Adrian Brody's in it. He's been in a couple others as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Adrian Brody was also a very funny character.
Yeah.
He plays, I think, the antagonist. He's one of them, but I'd say he's at the top of the antagonist chain.
Yeah.
What I found so, I don't know, new, maybe this is Wes Anderson's style. I'm sure it is, actually. But in the way he kind of changes... perspective on what is typically dramatic in a film and what is kind of left in the background. For example, when a character an important character dies, let's say, you know, he'll kind of like leave it like, oh yeah, and then they died. Mm-hmm. Whereas other films, that would be like a climactic moment.
No.
And other things were brought to the foreground that other films might not emphasize, which I thought was really interesting. I don't know.
Here's something interesting. I'm on the Wikipedia page for it right now, so take this with a grain of salt, though it is notated. Anderson chose to shoot the film in three different aspect ratios. 1:3:3, 1:8:5, and 23:5:1, one for each timeline. Mm. So yeah. Those are interesting choices.
So it looks, sounds like he actually did shoot 4:3 for that, which would make sense. I mean, you wouldn't want to be shooting 16:9 and then say, oh, let's crop it. Oh, shit, I shot it.
Yeah.
To be 69.
Yeah. And I'll jump in now with my thoughts
on that. Okay, like, hold on. Is this going to be your critical section about it?
Negative.
Because I want to get all the good things out before we talk about the
good things.
I have some good things to say about it too. I really enjoyed the placement of everything, and I think this is a very Wes Anderson thing, but like everything was either like in respect to the rule of thirds, but very like
it was symmetrical.
So very symmetrical.
That's another hallmark. There's some very good videos on YouTube that analyze tons of the shots from across all the Wes Anderson films, and he loves symmetry. Mm. Shots you can cut in half, and they're pretty much symmetrical.
Well, no, I did notice that, but I distinctly made a mental note about it. It appears symmetrical, but it's not. Something is slightly asymmetrical.
Yeah.
For example, when he's straight above the entrance to the hotel, looking straight down, and someone's walking in, it looks symmetrical, but one of the rugs is slightly off.
Interesting.
You know, and in the beginning, when the writer's talking to the camera, it looks symmetrical too, but the left side of the desk is just slightly higher. Mm-hmm. There's just always something, it reminds me of photographing someone's face. Mm. Usually people's faces they look symmetrical at first, but maybe one eye is slightly different. Like it was really interesting. There's always something slightly different in the symmetry, and I thought that was cool, but anyway.
David,
is it my turn?
Okay, so now David, you have some critical things.
But I have some nice things to say first. I'll say some nice things first. I did enjoy it overall. I thought the writing was wonderful. I thought the cinematography was great as well. I also love the way that Wes Anderson blends, not seamlessly, I think actually in some ways not seamlessly at all, but I think well, which is miniatures and stop motion with the rest of the film. Which was really, really well.
What were some miniatures?
Some of the long shots of the Grand Budapest Hotel and some of the like the observatory.
Mm-hmm. What about the prison? Was that a miniature? They did some wide exteriors of the prison.
I
don't think that one was.
Okay,
but the observatory was a lot of times when it looked like there was a fake background on it. That it was a miniature.
So that prison was a real place because that
potentially. Oh, and actually, was a big place. The Budapest Hotel is a real place. It's actually the Palace Bristol Hotel in Karlovy Vary, which is in Karlsblad.
What about those cable cars? They had the like they're almost like silhouettes. That was fake. Well, I figured that was fake.
But those kind of cable cars are real.
But the shot that he was getting was clearly.
Yeah, it was. So I love how he does that. And again, it's not seamlessly blended like say Lord of the Rings, but it's different. But I think I like that distinction. But I like that it works. Mm-hmm. You can go from a real scene to that, and doesn't bother me.
I think it's trying to break the tension a little. You know,
that's possible.
Make it look a little more comical.
Yeah. I know. And so like I said, overall, I did like it. I do think that the. And maybe this was the intent. It was sort of it was convoluted, and where the story ended was kind of strange. And I can't say too much more than that because I don't want to spoil how it ends. But if you guys know how some of the various storylines go, I feel like it just ended in some weird places, almost in a way that's okay. That's just sort of get this.
Sure, I could see that.
That's my main issue with it. But overall, it's not my favorite Wes Anderson film. I think my favorite is still Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, which I highly recommend if you haven't watched it. But
I mean, I see what you mean. You don't really necessarily leave the theater feeling like, oh, yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I take your points of critiquing.
Yeah, it's my cynical nature. I'm sorry.
You are. There's always something about every movie we review.
Well, wait. Which one did we watch last month? Wasn't
Lego Movie, but you hadn't seen it yet.
Oh, well, I saw it now, and I thought it was amazing, and it deserves an Oscar.
Oh, we're really good. retroactively praising it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now they're going to make Minecraft.
Yeah, by the same guys who did the Lego Movie. Awesome. I'm very curious. Well, one, I think it's going to be very interesting to watch. Two, I question, what kind of plot line are they going to devise up for that? So I wonder if they're going to go for the same kind of feel.
A dragon.
I wonder if they're going to do the same thing where, I wonder if they're going to do the same thing with the Lego Movie, where it's, you know, sort of two places at once. I don't want to say too much.
If anything, I think the Lego Movie just showed us that, you know, you can tell a story in any environment. Doesn't really matter your setting if you can tell a good story.
It was really nice to see a really good story that didn't have some other either pop culture or other like book something about that backed it up. So like Lego, you know, had like every Legos is all part of our childhood. Yeah, there's a book behind it. Hunger Games has a book behind it. Everything, there's always like a remake of something else, or like Marvel Universe and everything like that. It was just really nice to see a really strong, well-written movie that was original and creative.
Sure, I get that. And also, I mean, going back to the Lego Movie, you can watch that movie one time and say, okay, it was about, you know, working together, but also like being an individual, and it had all these clear cut themes, probably because it was geared towards all ages.
Yeah.
Budapest was clearly an R film.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was.
and you know, it doesn't have those clear cut themes. And I think again, warrants repeat viewing to kind of get a feel for what it's trying to say, because it's a little subtler and it tells its story in a different way. And I like the two different types of humor it went back and forth between. There was the kind of natural humor, the quiet humor, like when Zero was knocking on the giant door to the jail, and all of a sudden you could hear this like metal opening, and then he looks over and there's a smaller door. He's like, hey, this way. I don't know. That was kind of funny. But also that moment where Gustav is hanging by the cliff about to die, and the guy is standing above him, and then
he starts monologuing
poetry. Yeah, Gustav is like, no, he's going to die. So he starts reciting this beautiful poem. And then right in the middle of it, Zero comes behind and throws the guy off the edge, and he's, oh shit, you got it. So I don't know, I thought it balanced between those two humors really nicely, and I liked it. And so that was Grand Budapest. Sean, you saw a different movie
artistic movie.
Equally artistic and nuanced film. I won't call it a movie, I call it a film.
Yes, I saw the 300. It should not have been called a 300 film.
It was Rise to Empire, something like that.
Rise of the Empire,
which
whatever.
Takes place. It's essentially part two of the Persian Greek Wars, and basically Xerxes comes back years later to try again and invade Greece, according to history. Anyway, I don't know what happened in the film.
When it was filmed, it was filmed in parallel to the 300 movie that we all know about.
Mm-hmm.
It was about the Mysticles, and I think it was Greece. He was fighting for Greece. And the way that they did this was...
Deep breath.
Yeah, it was very frustrating. When I stood... There's some movies when I stand up in the theater and I say, damn it.
Did you do that?
I did that.
You stood up in the theater
and I said, God damn it. Because it literally had... It was filmed in parallel with the 300. It didn't pick up at the end of 300.
Are you saying it took place side by side?
Side by side.
Oh, that's dumb.
Exactly.
Well, the Bourne Ultimatum was done the same way too, but it was good. At least maybe I liked it. Everybody's giving me blank stares.
The
Bourne Ultimatum was filmed parallel. Like, there's a portion of Bourne Ultimatum that's parallel to the previous one.
The Bourne Supremacy?
Yes.
Are you sure?
Yes, positive.
Okay. keep going, Sean.
The name of this film should have been more. It should have stated that it's going to be focused on the Mysticles and the naval battle against Persia.
I thought it was from the trailers. I thought it was they were like on a rampage of revenge from the 300 guys that died. That's what the feeling I got from the trailers.
Yeah,
like, yeah, yeah.
We're gonna revenge these people that died.
Which they specified the martyrdom, that the reason why the Spartans died and united all of Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great
kind of
part.
Had a factor. Yeah.
Say again?
So it kind of had a factor of like they were encouraged by them.
Exactly. But the thing is, it was 90% about a war between the Mysticles and the Persian naval commander. There's few portions that I liked about it. I liked the backstory between Xerxes and how he was just an ordinary man, and because of anger of the death of his father by the Mysticles, sold his soul to the devil pretty much, and went into a river of I don't know, some magical water, and emerged a god king or a human god king.
So what made you stand up and say, damn it, I want to get at the heart of the anger?
Because they ended that pretty much there's going to be a third one, and it's going to be the one that we wanted. When at the end of the first 300, the guy with the eye patch, I don't even remember his name, is talking to all the foot soldiers behind him about ready to attack the Persians that are on a naval assault.
Oh, shit.
But the end of this one, it's the complete opposite. There's a naval assault from Greece, and Sparta finally joins the fight, led by the queen of Sparta, King Leonidas' wife.
Yeah.
I was
mad. And it ends with them going...
It ends with them about... Somehow the Spartans end up arriving at the same time that Greece...
Well, naturally.
So you got mad because you got blueballed, is essentially...
Yeah. I'm so pissed off.
Interesting way of putting it, but alrighty then. Yeah. I think we should find a better, more artistic film term.
So it's skippable.
Yeah, very. I'd say go 300 and then this third one.
Was this backed by the comics?
No.
I didn't read any graphics.
There is only one graphic novel. I have read it. It's by Frank Miller, and it's 300. And if you read it, it's a very short read. It's really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And if you watch that in 300, they basically took all of the graphic novel and they just sort of photocopied that and used that as the storyboards. Because it's the exact same stuff.
Hmm.
But yeah, these two new ones are just sort of expanding on the idea. There's nothing backing them up.
Gotcha.
Okay. So guys, I think that's where we're going to leave it for this month. Thanks for tuning in. I guess the takeaways here is don't see 300, the sequel.
And don't buy the Black Magic Ursa.
And see Grand Budapest Hotel.
Okay, all very good things to take away. So we're going to pick it up next month. We haven't decided the film yet, but it'll be great.
And get a sub pack.
Yeah, that as well. Have a good month, guys. We'll see you next time. Thanks for tuning in.